Thank you, team, for leading us in worship today on this Reformation Sunday. A little over 500 years ago on this day, reputed to be when Martin Luther nailed 95 theses to the door of a church, confronting what he saw to be some of the failings and ailings of the Roman Catholic Church. And we look back on the Reformation, the Revolution, that drastically changed the world that we live in now, some 500 years later. So altogether appropriate that we sing the song written by Martin Luther from the 1500s. The closing of the service, we're going to sing a song written by Martin Rinkert, who was an early Reformation Lutheran pastor from the 1600s. We sang a song, Jesus, Savior, Pilot Me, from the 1800s, written over 150 years ago. Songs from the 1900s, a couple of songs from 2000s, there is something about knowing that we have entered into something that it was not new, something that wasn't invented just a few years ago. We're not following a man or a cause that came just 100, 200 years ago, but that we are joined to a fellowship of believers, a body of saints that the Lord has been calling for thousands of years. And that what we do when we gather together in worship is not something we designed or we created, but that it's something that God has ordained for us. And we enter into this conversation, this life with God that's been going on long before we came into it. I missed meeting with you last week. Our family was in St. Louis for the weekend, first time away in about 14 months. It was good to be a family. It was good to have a special weekend. Danik's in that part of the year where his marching band is competing at national events, and so we'll be gone again in another couple of weeks as we go to Indianapolis, where his band will be playing in the Grand Nationals of this marching competition. We're going to take the weekend to follow the band as good band parents and follow along in a caravan of vehicles and semis that are going, and it's fun. Along the way, We saw some interesting road signs. This one was my favorite as we drove back across Missouri. God bless America, you know? Boots, bullets, britches, and baloney. I guess it's the four B's. It's all you need if you live in central Missouri. I hear if you have a mullet, you get a 10% discount, which means everybody in Carroll County gets a discount. I took this picture, and it just cracked me up as we're coming back across I-70. I don't know how I had noticed this sign before it hadn't struck me. And I sent it to my brother, who pastors in Southern California. Now, this is how you know whether you live in a red state or a blue state. When you have road signs for your boots, bullets, britches, and baloney, it's the only way you can say that, right? You got to have a little. Then you know that you live in a red state. I sent it to my brother, who pastors in a very blue state, and he said, if I put this up before my church, the hundreds of emails I would get complaining and arguing with me, I said, why, they don't like baloney in California? And he got a... But it got me thinking about some other signs that we could see. I thought this was creative. This builds strong teeth, and they're kind of showing how strong your teeth could be as the guy rips apart the... I thought, that's really genius. That's very well done. Timely reminder, when you're driving on the interstate, keep your seatbelt on or else you may... That's just pretty good. I don't know why this makes me laugh. The juxtaposition of the two signs. I'm a big guy. I have a right to laugh at this, right? It's like, childhood obesity. My kind of shopping spree. Might be causality there. I don't know. Some of you saw these. Oh, you know. When you think of God, what do you think of? This pops up in my brain. Some recess, not the front of the brain, but somewhere. Cheesy, beefy glory. I don't know. I saw that years ago, and it just has stuck with me. So there were a series of these signs that appeared all around the country. It's like, you kids, you know, calm down, or, you know, you kids play nice back there, God. And then this one, don't make me come down there, God. I thought, wow, that could be the summary of several of the minor prophets. Don't make me come down there, God. And as we looked at the first couple minor prophets in our series with Amos and Hosea, it really was what they were saying to the northern kingdom was basically, you're making God come down here. Now stop it. If he has to stop this car and come back there one more time, I mean, I heard that as a kid, right? You did too. Don't make me come back there. Don't make me stop this car. We're going to grandma's house. You kids in the back, because we were all the way in the back of the station wagon. I mean, there were six of us kids at different times, and my youngest brother, I was the littlest of them all. I was sitting in that little trundle seat in the back of the station wagon, no seat belts at all. We're facing backwards, going down the highway, 70 miles an hour. We survived somehow. And I heard that from my dad. Don't make me come back there. And, you know, we heard it enough where we thought it was just a thing, so we wouldn't stop until the day he actually stopped the car and came back there. Right there along the roadside, the belt came off, and wow. We learned when he says, don't make me stop this car and come back there, he means it. Sadly, the people of God kind of pushed him to the point where he said, you have gone so far from me. You have strayed so far. I can't let you carry my name anymore. I just can't let you say that you are my people. I can't let you say that you are representing me, because that's not what I look like. And so we saw from Amos and Hosea, God essentially saying this. Well, we turn now to Micah. And as we prepare to look at Micah, if I had to come up with a summary of what Micah had to say, it might be a different road sign, one that simply says, justice will reign. Justice will reign. There's a couple different ways you could take that. If you're sort of at the bottom of society, if you're sort of the low man on the totem pole, if you're sort of in the masses there where injustice has occurred so frequently, and you're the one who's been oppressed, you're the one who's been disadvantaged, you're the one who has been completely taken over by those in power over you, then this is good news. Justice will reign. And for some, even through Micah, this was good news that justice will reign. And it's good news for us today, because Micah is going to take us not only to what happened in his day, but it's Micah who's going to speak about the advent of Christ in some of the clearest ways. As we've already started to see, Hosea had a little bit of this and about this future day of the Lord that's coming. Micah's the one who will tell us, oh, Bethlehem, Ephratah, though you are small now, though you are small among the nations, out of you will come one who brings justice. We read in the Psalms this morning, Psalm 101, I don't know if you got it. Not just I will sing of the goodness of the Lord, the greatness of the Lord, the faithfulness of the Lord. I will sing of his justice. And all of a sudden, justice now becomes a central focus of the prophets, because for those who are in power, for those who deal unjustly, for those who have built a system on injustice, this is a stern warning. And so we're going to start looking at Micah's ministry of the justice that God is bringing. The justice that he was going to bring to Judah in his day, but also the justice that he will bring when Christ comes as Messiah. And then Micah also speaks a great deal about the day of justice that is coming, the day of righteousness that is coming, that is still future to us, and that great day of the Lord. And one of the Lord's major themes now in the prophets will be justice. But he wants to see justice done. But these will be timely and challenging messages out of Micah, as we live in a culture that speaks a great deal about justice, uses the word frequently in protests and gatherings and political campaigns and just throughout the culture. But what does it mean? What is the justice of the Lord? So I've been spending the last couple of weeks looking at Micah and just so deep into it and ready to go, and then I realized at some point, wait, we can't just turn from the northern kingdom and start looking at Micah in the southern kingdom. You know me, there's got to be a little bit of setting the scene. And so today, as we turn to Micah, we're going to try to set the scene a little bit. I want you to imagine this. Some of you who don't love going into all the history that I love going into, maybe don't love all the context that I give you. imagine that you were going to speak to someone or write about the Jewish experience of the 1900s. Just imagine that maybe in your AP Euro History class or just for some conference, you were needing to write a paper about the Jewish experience of the 1900s. Could you do that without ever mentioning World War I, World War II, the Holocaust, the late 1940s and the establishment of the nation of Israel and the Zionist movement? Imagine trying to describe the Jewish experience of the 1900s and never bringing up the great world wars, the Holocaust, all of these events that eventually turned to the establishment, the nation of Israel, perhaps the wars that Israel fought in the 1960s. Imagine none of that, and yet you try to understand the Jewish experience of the 1900s. You'd say, that's impossible. I mean, how could you talk about what it means to be Jewish? How could you talk about Jewish history, Jewish culture, the Jewish identity in the 1900s without talking about World War I and then that period between the Great Wars and what happened in Germany to bring about World War II and the Holocaust? And then the events that unfolded after. You'd have to. In fact, those would be the major things that you would talk about. So if we go back and look at Micah, who probably ministered from about 735 to 695, how could we not look at the events that were going on in his centuries, the things that were happening in the world that were so critical to determining why he brings the message that he brings? And so just as we've done, and we've tried to do at least with Jonah and Amos and Hosea, we're going to take a brief look, a brief look at setting the scene for Micah. And so we begin with just reminding us what happened with the northern kingdom of Israel, divided kingdom. People of God were 12 tribes. They settled in the land. There was the United Kingdom under Saul, David, and Solomon. The kingdom divides in 930 BC under Jeroboam the First. He takes the northern kingdom away. And we've seen that northern kingdom has really just been a mess for about 200 years. Just a series of bad kings. Not a single king in the northern kingdom that God says was a good king. Not a single one that the prophets commend for their behavior. And it's not a dynasty. I mean, it's just full of intrigue and murder and assassinations and takeovers. And we saw some of that a couple weeks ago in a chart. But what we find through the messages that we've seen is that for centuries, God was gracious and merciful. God was gracious and merciful. And we see even the words of the prophets, even Jonah saying, God, I knew that you were a gracious and merciful God. I knew that you were steadfast in your love, and your loving kindness would go on and on, and we've seen that you're gracious and merciful. And so for centuries to the northern kingdom, God was gracious and merciful. We saw that he sent to them Elijah and Elisha, perhaps two of the greatest prophets. They weren't writing prophets, so we don't have the book of Elijah or the book of Elisha, but their stories are amazing, and what they did. And it was all in an effort to speak to the kings and the princes and the judges and the people about turning back to God. God sent them Amos, whom we looked at. God sent them Hosea, who was like, guys, let me demonstrate for you the love of God and what God had him do in taking Gomer and showing, though, the apostasy, the way that the kingdom had turned from God. And yet God was still gracious and merciful over and over and time again. Even though she ultimately and completely rejected her God. So then eventually we see that justice reigned. Justice. And we may look at it as punishment. We may look at it in a variety of ways. But the scriptures would speak of what happened in Israel as being a just decision by God. So 2 Kings chapter 17, verses 1 through 6, just to look at a summary of what happened under Hosea. 2 Kings 17 says this, in the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, that's what was going on in the southern kingdom, Hoshea, the son of Elah, became king over Israel in Samaria, that's the northern kingdom. And he reigned 9 years, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came against him. And Hosea, the king of Israel, became a servant and paid tribute to the Assyrian king. They become a vassal kingdom. They come completely under the control of Assyria. And then the king of Assyria found out the conspiracy of Hosea. He had sent messages to So, which is a king of Egypt, and he'd offered no tribute to the king of Assyria, as he'd done year by year. So the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. So what happens? Assyria has overtaken the northern kingdom. Does the northern kingdom even then turn to God? Do they even then in their despair turn to God? Do they even then, knowing what Elijah and Elisha and Amos and Hosea have said, do they then turn to God? No, they turn to, of all places, Egypt. The one place, especially, that God had said, never make alliance with them again. I brought you out of Egypt. Don't turn back to those things of old. But they turn back to the things of old. And when the Assyrian king found out that they were conspiring against them, trying to get Egypt on their side to defeat Assyria, he took and he bound the king of Israel in prison. And then the king of Assyria invaded the whole land. And he went up to Samaria and he besieged it for 3 years. And in the ninth year of Hosea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria. They captured Israel and carried her away into exile to Assyria. They settled the people in Halah and Habor on the river of Gazan and in the cities of the Medes. History, 722 BC, Assyria comes for the final siege against Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom, completely overtakes it. And by 720 BC, they are completely wiped out. Tens of thousands dead. The city starved, put to famine, until finally they're overtaken. And Assyria doesn't just take some. They take all. Whoever doesn't die, whoever doesn't flee as refugees to the southern kingdom, we'll read about that in Micah, is taken back to Assyria. There's a map here that kind of shows the deportations, the people were taken. During that whole 9 years leading up to this, when Hosea was a vassal, people were being taken back to Assyria, back to Nineveh. Remember them? God uses those people to bring justice to Israel. Justice in his eyes, because they had turned time and time and time and time again against their God, had prostituted themselves, sold themselves to do evil, it will say later in chapter 17. So God brings the Assyrians against them, conquers those tribes in the north, and they're taken to Assyria, and then new people are planted back in that northern territory. People from Assyria and Babylon are sent back into that northern territory to take over the cities, to farm the land, to inhabit the villages. And Israel will never come back from its exile until a future day of the Lord that's coming, that the prophet spoke of, still future even in our time. Those 10 tribes of the northern kingdom are lost to history. Those 10 tribes have ceased to exist in our modern world. Whereas there are still Jews today who can trace their lineage back to the two southern tribes and to Judah, the 10 tribes are lost. Lost to history, just as God said would happen. So it was though he had been saying through the prophets for over 200 years, I am gracious and I am merciful, but if you continue to reject and reject and reject, then you're no longer my people. And so justice comes by way of Assyria. That happened in 722 BC. That happened while Micah is ministering down in the southern kingdom. Because Micah is going to be a prophet to the people in Judah. But while he's preaching and teaching and prophesying, the people see this is what happens up north. And when Assyria comes, they all try to invade the southern kingdom. That's going to come some into our story here in just a moment. So these are all things that are relevant to Micah's day. You can't talk about Micah. You can't understand what he's saying to the people without seeing. They saw what happened to the northern kingdom. They saw those tribes wiped out. They saw the land completely ravaged and destroyed. They saw God's people taken away to Assyria, never to return. You would think that would impact their thinking. And it seems like maybe it has. When we come to some of the kings in Micah's day, there are good things that happen. There are kings who turn back to God, maybe because of these events in 722. Now, if you've noticed, I didn't put these dates in, someone else did. I don't agree necessarily with all of them, but it gives us a general picture of what went on in the northern kingdom. So now we turn to the southern kingdom in Judah. Micah's timeline, approximately 735 to 695. Where do we get that from? Let's turn to Micah for the first time. We're only going to briefly look at Micah itself today. Because in Micah chapter 1, verse 1, he sets the scene a little bit for us. And he assumes you know who he's talking about. He assumes you understand what's going on because he's writing to a people who are living it. In Micah chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord, which came to Micah of Moresheth. Oh, and Moresheth happens to be a small city right up here by the border that would have happened, the border that would have been between Samaria and Jerusalem. We told you this is only about 30 miles apart. I mean, this area is just not much bigger than the entire Kansas City metropolitan area. But he lives in one of these border towns that gets overtaken by the Assyrians. So when he says that he's Micah of Moresheth, people know, oh, Moresheth, that's one of those cities that the Assyrians attacked. It had been a military city, a walled city, but it got wiped out by the Assyrians when they took away the northern kingdom. He comes from Moresheth in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, the kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. So this is what Micah sees during his reign. And he gives us the kings under which he serves, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Well, if we start looking at them, and we look at the years that they reigned, we'll see that Jotham reigned for about 20 years, and Ahaz for about 15 years, and Hezekiah for about 30 years. It's like, Micah was ministering for a long time. I mean, his book's not very big, but if he's under this entire period of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, say, well, he said he was under Jotham, but there was a co-regency here with Uzziah, and he doesn't mention Uzziah because these are all fathers and sons who reign together. Uzziah's son is Jotham, Jotham's son is Ahaz, Ahaz's son is Hezekiah, Hezekiah's son is Manasseh. Much unlike the northern kingdom, which was always in chaos, the southern kingdom follows the line of David. So you've got father and son and grandson and great-grandson and great-great-grandson, so that Manasseh's great-great-grandfather is Uzziah. I mean, it all just follows in order. And very often, as the king was getting older, he'd take his young son and make him king, but they would co-reign for 5, 10, 15 years until the older king actually passed on, and then the young son was already established as king and ready to rule. So some of these dates overlap between father and son. Micah does not say he was under Uzziah, so it's probably after 739, so we think probably about 735, and all the way through Hezekiah, but maybe not all the way to the end of Hezekiah's reign, because he has a co-regency with his son Manasseh by 695, so we say Micah was probably prophesying for about these 40 years between 735 and 695. You say, is this going to be on a test? Do I have to know these dates? No. But catch that what happens in this little book of Micah, which is only, what, 7 chapters long? That's 40 years worth of prophesying. It's 40 years worth of ministry. And during that 40 years, the country goes through significant changes, up and down. During this 40 years of ministry, it would seem during the middle part of his ministry to Ahaz that at least somebody was paying attention. And that Hezekiah hears the words of Jotham, and the people hear the, Hezekiah hears the words of Micah, and that the people hear the words of Micah, and their hearts turn to the Lord. Because Hezekiah the king will turn to the Lord. So this is the time period. These are the things that are going on. And we don't have time to look at all the stories. Uzziah, you can look in 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles is much like 2 Kings, where it tells the stories of the kings. 2 Chronicles is a little different because it only deals with the southern kingdom of Judah. It doesn't even talk about Israel in the north. So you can find out about Uzziah in 2 Chronicles. Just want to, for sake of time, we can't read much of this, but I do want to drop in and just look at 2 Chronicles, chapter 26. Uzziah was a good king. And most of us, what we know of him is this thing that Isaiah says in the year that King Uzziah died, and that's when Isaiah got his calling. But in 2 Chronicles chapter 26, Uzziah is strong. Verse 4 had said he did right in the sight of the Lord according to what his father Amaziah had done. Verse 5 said he continued to seek God in the days of Zechariah, to understand him through the vision of God. As long as he sought the Lord, God prospered him. So he was a godly king who followed the Lord. The Lord made him strong and mighty. He increased the borders. He got everybody ready for battle. He had a huge standing army. But then we come to verse 16. But when he became strong, his heart was so proud that he acted corruptly. He was unfaithful to the Lord his God. He entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. Why is that a problem? Because he's not a Levite. He's from the tribe of Judah. He's a descendant of David. He's not a priest. He's not of the priestly tribe. He's not allowed to go into the temple of God, to the Holy of Holies, to burn incense. But in his greatness and power, he evidently decided, I'm God's man. Look at the way that God has blessed me. I'm the man of God. Why can't I offer my own sacrifice? I'm closer to God than many of these priests. And so he went in. And Azariah the priest entered in after King Uzziah, and with him 80 priests of the Lord, valiant men. Why are they valiant men? Read what follows in verse 18. They opposed King Uzziah. Can you imagine the courage of these men? Here a king has come, probably with his royal retinue, decided he is such a man of God, he's going to go in and offer incense for himself and sacrifice for himself. The priests opposed him, and the king said, it's not for you, they opposed Uzziah the king, and the priest said, it's not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Get out of the sanctuary. You've been unfaithful, and you will have no honor from the Lord God. But Uzziah, with the censer in his hand for burning incense, was enraged. Why? Because he's king. He's got the power. He's the authority. He's the one in control. While he was enraged with the priest, and can you imagine what he's about to do? He's got this censer burning incense in his hand. The priests are opposing him. I'm just imagining he's about to swing it at him. He's just about to take violence into his own hands and go after the priest. As he's standing there, as he's enraged, leprosy broke out on his forehead before the priest in the house of the Lord, beside the altar of incense. Azariah, the chief priest, and all the priests looked at him. Behold, he was leprous on his forehead, and they hurried him out of there. And he himself hastened to get out, because the Lord had smitten him, and he knew it. And King Uzziah was a leper to the day of his death, and he lived in a separate house, being a leper. He was cut off from the house of the Lord. And if you read the end of verse 23, it says, Uzziah slept with his fathers. They buried him with his fathers in the field of a grave which belonged to the king. And they said, he's a leper. That's his epithet. The epitaph that should have read, here lies Uzziah the great king, the one who brought decades of peace to Judah. Here lies the great one whom God has blessed so richly and expanded our borders. Instead, the epitaph says, here lies a leper. His son is Jotham. His son is the first king that then Micah has contact with. And it's during the time of his son Jotham, who saw this, who was a part of this, who co-reigned with his father during those last 11 years that his father had leprosy before he died. Co-reigned from a separate house because his father could no longer go amongst the people because of the leprosy. Jotham saw it. Jotham saw it and understood. And we'll see in 2 Chronicles 27, were we to read it, verse 6 simply says, Jotham became mighty because he ordered his ways before the Lord his God. Maybe learn some lessons from Dad. Judah has some good kings. And so some of Micah's prophecy is during this time where there are good kings, there are good things going on in the nation. But part of what we'll find is that Micah, coming from this small town, he ministers to the common people. Even if we were to look back In Micah in chapter 1, I'll just read it for you. He starts his prophecy this way: "Hear, O peoples, hear all of you." His prophecy is not directed at the kings. His prophecy is not directed at Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah. But someone else's is, because Micah is going to be a contemporary minister at the same time, we've already brought him up, as Isaiah. Because Isaiah is called by God in the year that King Uzziah died, in 739. So Isaiah is going to become a prophet to the kings. Isaiah comes from a family of nobility. He comes from the aristocracy of Judah. He comes from that upper crust, that upper class. He fits well into that. And Isaiah is going to speak directly to the kings, to the princes, to the noblemen. Micah, meanwhile, during much of the same time, the same decades, is going to speak to the common people, the lower level people, the average businessman, the average people with a tent in the marketplace. That's who Micah is going to speak to. He'll reference the kings and the princes, but most of his message is to common people, kind of more like us. And so for 40 years, Micah is going to speak to the common man, the common people, about what God wants from them. So as we look at this time, we've seen the kings, there's summaries of their stories, but we could spend a lot of time looking at the individual stories. Hezekiah we'll try to look at briefly. But what's going on in the southern kingdom? Well, we have the prophets, not just the kings, but the prophets. Isaiah, Micah. At the same time, we also have a number of false prophets that we're going to have to deal with. Just like we've seen in all of the other books. Just like we saw in the days of Elijah, who confront 450 prophets of Baal and another 400 prophets of Asherah. Micah is going to speak often of the false prophets. These are some of the things he says in Micah chapter 2, verse 11. And we're going to be going back through this book over the weeks to come, but these are some of the summary things to look at. Micah 2:11, this is what he says to the people. You know, if a man walked after wind and falsehood, and he told lies and said, "I'll speak to you concerning wine and liquor," he'd be a spokesman for you people. That's the kind of prophets you listen to. That's the kind of guy you're looking for. Now, I know we're like, well, that would never happen in a church like ours. It happened in a church that I was a part of years ago. We had a guy who ran a bar downtown, Pitch Magazine called the best little saloon in Kansas City. They were known for their Bloody Mary Sundays. And he soon became a spokesman for the church. And he worked his way in with some of the upper leadership. And he began to speak to the people and for the people and ran a Sunday school class that a group of influential people in the church were in. And he led them astray and began teaching things that were so apart from Scripture. And he just held sway over a whole group of the people. Why? Because they wanted something new. They wanted something different. They were intrigued by the things. We've never heard teaching like this before. I was in the youth department. I decided things are filtering down through some of our youth parents. What is this stuff? I went and sat in this class for weeks and went, well, I know why you've never heard teaching like that before. This is false teaching. It's horrible. It was just, they were going through Romans and it was devastating what they were doing. And I was just shocked and amazed. But he'd aligned himself with the senior pastor and became a spokesman for the people. Micah says, someone came chasing the wind and falsehood and telling lies, saying, I'll speak to you concerning wine and liquor. Well, he'd be your spokesman. He'd be the ones you would follow. Micah speaking to the common people. Chapter 3, this is what he says in verses 5 through 7. Thus says the Lord concerning your prophets who lead my people astray. When they've got something to bite with their teeth, they cry peace. In other words, if you feed them, if you pay them, they say good things. But against him who puts nothing in their mouth, they declare holy war. You don't feed them, you don't pay them, they curse you. Therefore, it will be night for you all without vision, darkness for you without divination. The sun will go down on your prophets, the day will become dark over them. Your seers will be ashamed, your diviners will be embarrassed. They will cover their mouths because there's no answer from God. You see the situation, no matter what was happening with the kings, the people had to make their own choices. The people had to follow, and they were following false prophets. pay them off. They'll say whatever you want. Look at verse 11 of chapter 3. Her leaders pronounce judgments for a bribe, her priests instruct for a price, and her prophets divine for money. But they lean on the Lord, saying, isn't the Lord in our midst? No calamity will come upon us. You know, tonight, in a fun way, there's going to be millions of people in our country wearing a different kind of mask. We've all been wearing masks for like a year and a half, right? We're sick of. But they're going to be wearing different masks. Halloween masks, costumes, make-believe, going out trick-or-treating. And there's going to be kids just having fun, acting like somebody else, having a mask on. Micah is essentially saying, all your leaders have a mask on. They're all hypocrites. They're all under a mask. They're all pretending to be one thing, but they're not. They say they lean on the Lord. That's the same word from Proverbs 3:5. Lean on the Lord, not your own understanding. Don't lean on your own understanding. They say they're leaning on the Lord, but they're not. They prophesy for money. That's all they're about. And Micah is going to speak of these false prophets repeatedly throughout the book. Some of the dangers that affect us, not just what's going on in alliances and political and military. And I mean, what did the average person in Judah have to do with an alliance with Assyria or Judah or Moab? Nothing. We do as we're told, right? But we can't control what's going on a national level in our own country today. There's frustrations politically. Some of us feel like there's injustice and there's things that are wrong and there's things that shouldn't be. And, you know, whatever media source you read, from what angle you read, you can just get angry really easily about these things that are going on a national level. And we can feel angry and we can feel disgusted or we can feel oppressed or we can feel whatever. What can we do about it? There's nothing we can do about it. That's part of the frustration and the anger. Micah is speaking to people saying, listen, whatever is going on in the kingdom, whatever is going on in the political alliances, you have to be faithful. You have to decide what you're going to listen to, and you have to decide how you are going to live. Isaiah is going to speak to the kings and the princes, nobility. Micah speaks to the rest of us. He warns the false prophets. And so does Isaiah. Isaiah in chapter 28 speaks quite a bit about the false prophets because they're affecting the leaders and the political things at a higher level. But Micah's challenging us. Well, we also, to understand really what Micah's talking about, we need to look not just at the northern kingdom and not just at the southern kingdom, but also we need to look at the enemy. The enemy, which is Assyria. We saw the map a little while ago, how they had come, and as a tool of God, God used them to take away the northern kingdom. God allowed them to come and invade, in fact, maybe even sent them to come and invade, and take away the people from the northern kingdom of Israel. But then they're going to come down into Judah as well. And they're going to come up against the city of Jerusalem itself. And they're going to do this in the days of Hezekiah. And I just briefly this morning want to try to look at the story. Now, here's the interesting thing in putting this context together. You can look at 2 Kings. And it gives you a summary of each of the kings. Now, just the kings of Judah from now on. And there's maybe a half a chapter or a chapter. Sometimes, like Hezekiah, gets a couple of chapters of a summary. You can look in 2 Chronicles, and it's going to summarize the kings. And sometimes says the exact same thing. Sometimes gives a different story, a different illustration of why that king was good or bad. Gives a little more information. But then the individual prophets themselves write about some of the things that are going on with the kings. And so for this, in the book of Isaiah, we can turn to Isaiah chapter 36 and 37. Because Isaiah is going to write in depth about some of the history and some of the events that were taking place during this time. Matches up with 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, but Isaiah gives a much expanded picture of what's going on during this time. 2 Kings 18 we could go to, but Isaiah chapter 36. I'll try to summarize for you, and I'm just going to read quickly through this. It came about in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against the fortified city of Judah and seized them. He'd already wiped out the northern kingdom, taken them captive. Now they're coming down to the southern kingdom. The king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh. And Rabshakeh is going to be his spokesman. Rabshakeh is going to be his right-hand man who actually speaks to the people of Jerusalem. And he sent him to Jerusalem to King Hezekiah with a large army, and he stood by the conduit of the upper pool on the highway of the Fuller's Field, basically right above the city where he thought everybody who's near the wall, at the wall, where the armies could all hear him. Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and Joash, son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to him. So some of the envoys from Jerusalem went out. And Rabshakeh said to them, "Tell Hezekiah, thus says our great king, the king of Assyria, what's this confidence that you have? I say, your counsel and strength for war are only empty words. On whom do you rely that you've rebelled against me? Behold, you rely on a staff of this crushed reed. You rely on Egypt, on which if a man leans, it'll go into his hand and pierce it. So is the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all who rely on him." So he assumed that he'd made alliances with Egypt. He assumed that was their hope and their understanding. "But if you say to me," I mean, if you really want to hold this position, "we trust in the Lord our God," well, isn't it he whose high places and altars Hezekiah took away? See, they totally misunderstand her worship. They totally misunderstand her beliefs. Hezekiah took away the false altars to the pagan gods. Hezekiah cleaned house in Judah. Hezekiah wiped out those altars to the Asherah, to the Baals, and to the others. Assyrians don't understand that as a polytheistic people. It's like, well, hasn't he destroyed your religion? It's lies. He doesn't even understand what the people of God stand on, but he tries to use their words against him. "Well, if you were really like your Jesus, well, didn't your Jesus say, well, don't you know the Bible's full of errors? Well, don't have you heard that kind of stuff? The enemy doesn't know. People don't understand the truth that we stand on, but they say, well, do you really think that stuff is real? You really think that stuff is true? You know the Bible's full of errors. Well, you know that it's just been used as a tool to oppress women and minorities and race. You know that it's all..." Without it knowing anything. It's 2,800 years ago. Same stuff was going on. "If you really say, we trust in the Lord our God, are you really going to worship before his altar?" Verse 8. "Now therefore, come." Here we go. "Make a bargain with my master." Make a bargain. That's the way out of it. They come with fear, they come with armies, they come with lies. Read the story. We don't have time for it today. But this is the place where we land. Not just the fear, not just the lies, but the alluring danger of compromise with the enemy. Now, I don't mean compromise within the church. "Well, I want the walls this color. We want them that color." Compromise. "We think the chair should be arranged this way, not that way." "We think the worship style, this or that." Compromise. "We don't think you should preach what the Bible says anymore." Don't compromise. "Well, we don't think you should be able to teach your kids anymore about..." Don't compromise. We never compromise with the enemy. But the enemy comes and says, "Make a bargain. Make a bargain." What did Satan himself say to Jesus himself? "Hey, make a bargain. You know, if you bow down and worship me here, I'll give you all the kingdoms of the earth." The same lies. And there will constantly be, I believe Micah is going to show us this, there's constantly going to be, through false prophets, through things in our culture, through events that are going on, there's constantly going to be the temptation to compromise with the enemy. To compromise against the truth. And when you start to go there, you've lost your hope. You've lost the hope of God being behind you and being faithful through you because you've left him. The story is amazing. I urge you, read it this week. Read Isaiah 36 and 37. Because here's what I found in rereading it. The enemy today still deals in the same thing. Fear, lies, and the alluring danger of compromise. So what do we do? What did Hezekiah do in this situation? If you read the story from 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, Hezekiah was amazing because he turned to the greatness of God. He went and found Isaiah and said, "Isaiah, what does the God of Israel want me to do?" He humbled himself, sackcloth and ashes, spread himself out in front of the Lord God with the counsel of Isaiah the prophet and said, "God, you tell us what to do, and we will wait for your answer." And he never compromised with the enemies of God. As we approach Micah, we're going to see these amazing stories of God's justice. God's justice will reign. There was a priest, a pastor, a clergyman, I mentioned his name earlier, Martin Rinkert. Born in 1586, lived up through the mid-1600s. I didn't know much about him. I knew I'd sang this song that he wrote, but I didn't know much about the man at all. He's a German Lutheran pastor early on after the Reformation, also became a poet laureate, but he was minister, pastor, in Saxony during the 30 Years' War. Again, where's those AP Euro students? You know, 1618, 1648, before the Peace of Westphalia. No? Nothing? Okay. 30 Years' War involved almost all of Europe, particularly what was Germany at the time, Bohemia, the Swedes, the Danes, the Spanish, the Dutch, the French. I mean, everybody's involved in this massive war for decades. In the midst of war, a plague came to Europe, a plague that wiped out more than half the population of some areas. And it came to the city where Rinkert lived. He began performing over a number of months 50 funerals a day. In all, he buried more than 4,500 people, including his wife and some of his own children, from the plague, in the midst of a war-torn country where constantly armies were coming through. Because of the war and because of the plague, then famine came after the plague. Famine so bad that Rinkert writes that one day he observed in the street 25 people fighting over a dead cat. Horrific. Horrific. How do you go through that? You turn to God. And you trust in God. And you depend on God. At the end of the 30 Years' War, the Swedish army, who kind of liberated his area, wanted to exact tribute from them, demanded 30,000 florins, their currency of the day. Everything the priest had had, he'd given away to people to feed them. They constantly were at his door. He died at an early age because of undernourishment, and he was barely able to keep his remaining children alive because he did so much for the rest of the city. When the Swedish general comes, he finds out that this old pastor is the one that everybody kind of listens to, and so he demanded that he tell the people, "We need 30,000 florins in tribute." And Martin begged that they would lower the cost. "We have nothing. We're an impoverished people, plague, famine, war." And the general wouldn't listen to him at all and said, "We demand it or else we're going to wipe out the city." And this minister, with his friends around him, said, "If man will not listen to us, perhaps God will." And right there, he dropped on his knees and prayed. And prayed. And prayed. And prayed so earnestly that this Swedish commander looked at him and looked at his faith and said, "No longer is the tribute 30,000 or even 20,000 or 10. But we have to take some 2,000 we'll take from the city and then we'll go." In the midst of it, the minister writes these words, "Now thank we all our God with heart and hands and voices, who wondrous things has done, in whom his world rejoices." After 30 years of war and famine and plague, "All praise and thanks to God, the Father, now be given, the Son and him who reigns with him in highest heaven, the one eternal God, whom earth and heaven adore. For thus it was, it is now, and shall be evermore." So as Lewis and James come, they're going to lead us in this hymn, number 556.